Side 8. The Bachman Books, 4 Early Novels. Continuing with The Long Walk, on page 235.
I cried, McBreeze said. I cried like a baby. I got down on my knees and held her skirt and begged her to forgive me, and all the blood was getting on the floor. It was a basically disgusting scene, Garrity. She gagged and ran off into the bathroom. She threw up. I could hear her throwing up. When she came out, she had a towel for my face. She said she never wanted to see me again. She was crying. She asked me why I'd done that to her, hurt her like that. She said I had no right. There I was, Ray, with my face cut wide open, and she's asking me why I hurt her.
Yeah.
I left with the towel still on my face. I had 12 stitches, and that's the story of the fabulous scar, and aren't you happy?
Have you ever seen her since?
No, McBreeze said. And I have no real urge to. She seems very small to me now. Very far away. Pris, at this point in my life, is no more than a speck on the horizon. She really was mental, Ray. Something... her mother, maybe. Her mother was a lush. Something had fixed her on the subject of money. She was a real miser. Distance lends perspective, they say. Yesterday morning, Pris was still very important to me. Now she's nothing. That story I just told you, I thought that would hurt. It didn't hurt. Besides, I doubt if all that shit really has anything to do with why I'm here. It just made a handy excuse at the time.
What do you mean?
Why are you here, Garrity?
I don't know.
His voice was mechanical, doll-like. Freaky D'Alessio hadn't been able to see the ball coming. His eyes weren't right. His depth perception was screwed. It had hit him in the forehead and branded him with stitches. And later, or earlier, all of his past was mixed up and fluid now. He had hit his best friend in the mouth with the barrel of an air rifle. Maybe he had a scar like McFreeze. Jimmy. He and Jimmy had been playing doctor.
You don't know,
McFreeze said. You're dying and you don't know why. It's not important after you're dead.
Yeah, maybe, McFreeze said.
But there's one thing you ought to know, Ray, so it won't all be so pointless.
What's that?
Why, that you've been had. You mean you really didn't know that, Ray? You really didn't?
Chapter 9.
Very good, Northwestern. Now, here is your 10-point toss-up question. Alan Ludden, College Bull. At 1 o'clock, Garrity took inventory again. 115 miles traveled. They were 45 miles north of Old Town, 125 miles north of Augusta, the state capital. 150 to Freeport, or more. He was terribly afraid there were more than 25 miles between Augusta and Freeport. Probably 230 to the New Hampshire border. And the word was that this walk was sure to go that far. For a long while, 90 minutes or so, no one at all had been given a ticket. They walked, they half-listened to the cheers from the sidelines, and they stared at mile after monotonous mile of piney woods. Garrity discovered fresh twinges of pain in his left calf to go with the steady wooden throbbing that lived in both of his legs and the low-key agony that was his feet. Then around noon, as the day's heat mounted toward its zenith, the guns began to make themselves heard again. A boy named Tressler, 92, had a sunstroke and was shot as he lay unconscious. Another boy suffered a convulsion and got a ticket as he crawdaddied on the road, making ugly noises around his swallowed tongue. Aronson, 1, cramped up in both feet and was shot on the white line, standing like a statue, his face turned up to the sun in neck-straining concentration. And at 1:05, another boy, Garrity did not know, had a sunstroke.
This is where I came in, Garrity thought, walking around the twitching, mumbling form on the road where the rifles sight in.
seeing the jewels of sweat in the exhausted and soon-to-be-dead boy's hair. This is where I came in. Can't I leave now? The guns roared, and a covey of high school boys sitting in the scant shade of a scout camper applauded briefly. I wish the Major would come through, Baker said pettishly. I want to see the Major. What? Abraham asked mechanically. He had grown gaunter in the last few hours. His eyes were sunk deeper in their sockets. The blue suggestion of a beard patched his face. So I can piss on him, Baker said. Relax, Garrity said. Just relax. All three of his warnings were gone now. You relax, Baker said. See what it gets you. You've got no right to hate the Major. He didn't force you. Force me? Force me? He's killing me, that's all. It's still not... Shut up, Baker said curtly, and Garrity shut. He rubbed the back of his neck briefly and stared up into the whitish-blue sky. His shadow was a deformed huddle almost beneath his feet. He turned up his third canteen of the day and drained it. Baker said, I'm sorry. I surely didn't mean to shout. My feet... Sure, Garrity said. We're all getting this way, Baker said. I sometimes think that's the worst part. Garrity closed his eyes. He was very sleepy. You know what I'd like to do? Pearson said. He was walking between Garrity and Baker. Piss on the Major, Garrity said. Everybody wants to piss on the Major. When he comes through again, we'll gang up on him and drag him down and all unzip and drown him, and that isn't what I want to do. Pearson was walking like a man in the last stages of conscious drunkenness. His head made half rolls on his neck. His eyelids snapped up and down like spastic window blinds. It's got nothing to do with the Major. I just want to go into the next field and lay down and close my eyes. Just lay there on my back in the wheat. They don't grow wheat in Maine, Garrity said. It's hay. In the hay, then. And compose myself a poem while I go to sleep. Garrity fumbled in his new food belt and found nothing in most of the pouches. Finally, he happened on a wax pack of saltines and began washing them down with water. I feel like a sieve, he said. I drink it, and it pops out on my skin 2 minutes later. The guns roared again, and another figure collapsed gracelessly like a tired jack-in-the-box. 45, Scram said, joining them. I don't think we'll even get to Portland at this rate. You don't sound so good, Pearson said. And there might have been careful optimism in his voice. Lucky for me, I got a good constitution, Scram said cheerfully. I think I be running a fever now. Jesus, how do you keep going? Abraham asked, and there was a kind of religious fear in his voice. Me? Talk about me, Scram said. Look at Hib. How does he keep going? That's what I'd like to know. And he cocked his thumb at Olson. Olson had not spoken for 2 hours. He had not touched his newest canteen. Greedy glances were shot at his food belt, which was also almost untouched. His eyes, darkly obsidian, were fixed straight ahead. His face was speckled by 2 days of beard, and it looked sickly vulpine. Even his hair, frizzed up in back and hanging across his forehead in front, added to the overall impression of ghoulishness. His lips were parched dry and blistering. His tongue hung over his bottom lip like a dead serpent on the lip of a cave. Its healthy pinkness had disappeared. It was dirty gray now. Road dust clung to it. He's there, Garrity thought. Sure he is. Where Stebbins said we'd all go if we stuck with it long enough. How deep inside himself is he? Fathoms? Miles? Light years? How deep and how dark? And the answer came back to him. Too deep to see out. He's hiding down there in the darkness, and it's too deep to see out. Olson, he said softly. Olson? Olson didn't answer. Nothing moved but his feet.
I wish he'd put his tongue in, at least, Pearson whispered nervously. The walk went on. The woods melted back, and they were passing through another wide place in the road. The sidewalks were lined with cheering spectators. Garrity signs again predominated. Then the woods closed in again, but not even the woods could hold the spectators back now. They were beginning to line the soft shoulders. Pretty girls in shorts and halters. Boys in basketball shorts and muscle shirts. Gay holiday, Garrity thought. He could no longer wish he wasn't here. He was too tired and numb for retrospect. What was done. Nothing in the world would change it. Soon enough, he supposed, it would even become too much of an effort to talk to the others. He wished he could hide inside himself like a little boy rolled up inside a rug with no more worries. Then everything would be much simpler. He had wondered a great deal about what McBreeze had said. That they had all been swindled, rooked. But that couldn't be right, he insisted stubbornly to himself. One of them had not been swindled. One of them was going to swindle everyone else. Wasn't that right? He licked his lips and drank some water. They passed a small green sign that informed them the main turnpike was 44 miles hence. That's it, he said to no one in particular. 44 miles to Old Town. No one replied, and Garrity was just considering taking a walk back up to McBreeze, when they came to another intersection, and a woman began to scream. The traffic had been roped off, and the crowd pressed eagerly against the barriers and the cops manning them. They waved their hands, their signs, their bottles of suntan lotion. The screaming woman was large and red-faced. She threw herself against one of the waist-high sawhorse barriers, toppling it and yanking a lot of the bright yellow guard rope after it. Then she was fighting and clawing and screaming at the policemen who held her. The cops were grunting with effort. I know her, Garrity thought. Don't I know her? The blue kerchief, the belligerent gleaming eyes, even the navy dress with the crooked hem, they were all familiar. The woman's screams had become incoherent. One pinwheeling hand ripped stripes of blood across the face of one of the cops holding her, trying to hold her. Garrity passed within 10 feet of her. As he walked past, he knew where he had seen her before. She was Percy's mom, of course. Percy, who had tried to sneak into the woods and had snuck right into the next world instead. I want my boy, she hollered. I want my boy. The crowd cheered her enthusiastically and impartially. A small boy behind her spat on her leg and then darted away. Jan, Garrity thought. I'm walking to you, Jan. Fuck this other shit. I swear to God I'm coming. But McBreeze had been right. Jan hadn't wanted him to come. She had cried. She had begged him to change his mind. They could wait. She didn't want to lose him. Please, Ray, don't be dumb. The long walk is nothing but murder. They had been sitting on a bench beside the bandstand. It had been a month ago, April, and he had his arm around her. She had been wearing the perfume he had gotten her for her birthday. It seemed to bring out the secret girl smell of her, a dark smell, fleshy and heady. I have to go, he had told her. I have to, don't you understand? I have to. Ray, you don't understand what you're doing. Ray, please don't. I love you. Well, he thought now, as he walked on down the road. She was right about that. I sure didn't understand what I was doing. But I don't understand it even now. That's the hell of it, the pure and simple hell of it. Garrity? He jerked his head up, startled. He had been half asleep again. It was McBreeze walking beside him. How you feeling? Feeling? Garrity said cautiously. All right, I guess. I guess I'm all right. Barkovich is cracking, McBreeze said with quiet joy. I'm sure of it. He's talking to himself, and he's limping. You're limping, too, Garrity said. So's Pearson. So am I. My foot hurts, that's all. But Barkovich, he keeps rubbing his leg. I think he's got a pulled muscle. Why do you hate him so much? Why not Collie Parker, or Olson, or all of us? Because Barkovich knows what he's doing. He plays to win, you mean? You don't know what I mean, Ray. I wonder if you do yourself, Garrity said. Sure, he's a bastard. Maybe it takes a bastard to win.
good guys finish last?
How the hell should I know?
They passed a clapboard one-room schoolhouse. The children stood out in the play yard and waved. Several boys stood atop the jungle gym like sentries, and Garrity was reminded of the men in the lumber yard a ways back.
"Garrity!"
one of them yelled.
"Ray Garrity! Garrity!"
A small boy with a tousled head of hair jumped up and down on the top level of the jungle gym, waving with both arms. Garrity waved back half-heartedly. The boy flipped over, hung upside down by the backs of his legs, and continued to wave. Garrity was a little relieved when he and the schoolyard were out of sight. That last had been a little too strenuous to bear thinking about for long. Pearson joined them.
"I've been thinking."
"Save your strength," McBreeze said.
"Feeble man, that is feeble."
"What have you been thinking about?" Garrity asked.
"How tough it's going to be for the second to last guy."
"Why so tough?" McBreeze asked.
"Well,"
Pearson rubbed his eyes, then squinted at a pine tree that had been struck by lightning sometime in the past.
"You know, to walk down everybody, absolutely everybody but that last guy. There ought to be a runner-up prize, that's what I think."
"What?" McBreeze asked flatly.
"I don't know."
"How about his life?" Garrity asked.
"Who'd walk for that?"
"Nobody before the walk started, maybe.
But right now, I'd be happy enough with just that. The hell with the prize, the hell with having my every heart's desire. How about you?"
Pearson thought about it for a long time.
"I just don't see the sense of it," he said at last, apologetically.
"You tell him, Pete," Garrity said.
"Tell him what? He's right. The whole banana or no banana at all."
"You're crazy," Garrity said, but without much conviction. He was very hot and very tired, and there were the remotest beginnings of a headache in back of his eyes. "Maybe this is how sunstroke starts," he thought. "Maybe that would be the best way, too, just go down in a dreamy, slow-motion half-knowingness and wake up dead."
"Sure," McBreeze said amiably. "We're all crazier, we wouldn't be here. I thought we'd thrashed that out a long time ago. We want to die, Ray. Haven't you got that through your sick, thick head yet? Look at Olson, a skull on top of a stick. Tell me he doesn't want to die. You can't. Second place? It's bad enough that even one of us has got to get gypped out of what he really wants."
"I don't know about all that fucking psycho history," Pearson said finally. "I just don't think anyone should get to cop out second."
Garrity burst out laughing.
"You're nuts," he said.
McBreeze also laughed. "Now you're starting to see it my way. Get a little more sun, stew your brain a little more, and we'll make a real believer out of you." The walk went on. The sun seemed neatly poised on the roof of the world. The mercury reached 79 degrees. One of the boys had a pocket thermometer. At 80, trembled in its grasp for a few broiling minutes. 80, Garrity thought. 80. Not that hot. In July, the mercury would go 10 degrees higher.
80. Just the right temperature to sit in the backyard under an elm tree, eating a chicken salad on lettuce.
80. Just the ticket for belly flopping into the nearest piece of the Royal River. Oh, Jesus, wouldn't that feel good? The water was warm on the top, but down by your feet it was cold, and you could feel the current pull at you just a little. And there were suckers by the rocks, but you could pick them off if you weren't a pussy. All that water, bathing your skin, your hair, your crotch. His hot flesh trembled as he thought about it. 80. Just right for shucking down to your swim trunks and laying up in the canvas hammock in the backyard with a good book. And maybe drowse off. Once he had pulled Jan into the hammock with him and they had lain there together, swinging and necking, until his cock felt like a long hot stone against his lower belly. She hadn't seemed to mind. 80. Christ in a Chevrolet, 80 degrees. 80, 80, 80, 80. Make it nonsense, make it gone. "I'd never been so hodded my whole life," Scram said through his plugged nose. His broad face was red and dripping sweat. He had stripped off his shirt and bared his shaggy torso. Sweat was running all over him like small creeks in spring flow.
"You better put your shirt back on," Baker said. "You'll catch a chill when the sun starts to go down. Then you'll really be in trouble."
"This goddamn code," Scram said. "I'd be pretty gub."
"It'll rain," Baker said. His eyes searched the empty sky. "It has to rain."
"It doesn't have to do a goddamn thing," Collie Parker said. "I never seen such a fucked up state."
"If you don't like it, why don't you go on home?" Garrity asked and giggled foolishly.
"Stuff it up your ass."
Garrity forced himself to drink just a little from his canteen. He didn't want water cramps. That would be a hell of a way to buy out. He'd had them once, and once had been enough. He had been helping their next-door neighbors, the Elwells, get in their hay. It was explosively hot in the loft of the Elwells' barn, and they had been throwing up the big 70-pound bales in a fireman's relay. Garrity had made the tactical mistake of drinking 3 dipperfuls of the ice-cold water Mrs. Elwell had brought out. There had been sudden blinding pain in his chest and belly and head. He had slipped on some loose hay and had fallen bonelessly out of the loft and into the truck. Mr. Elwell held him around the middle with his work-calloused hands while he threw up over the side, weak with pain and shame. They had sent him home, a boy who had flunked one of his first manhood tests, hay rash on his arms and chaff in his hair. He had walked home, and the sun had beaten down on the back of his sunburned neck like a 10-pound hammer. He shivered convulsively, and his body broke out momentarily in heat bumps. The headache thumped sickishly behind his eyes. How easy it would be to let go of the rope. He looked over at Olson. Olson was there. His tongue was turning blackish. His face was dirty. His eyes stared blindly. "I'm not like him. Dear God, not like him. Please, I don't want to go out like Olson."
"This'll take the starch out," Baker said gloomily. "We won't make it into New Hampshire. I'd bet money on it."
"2 years ago they had sleet," Abraham said. "They made it over the border. 4 of them did, anyway."
"Yeah, but the heat's different," Jensen said. "When you're cold, you can walk faster and get warmed up. When you're hot, you can walk slower and get iced. What can you do?"
"No justice," Collie Parker said angrily. "Why couldn't they have the goddamn walk in Illinois, where the ground's flat?"
"I like Bain," Scram said.
"Why do you swear so much, Parker?"
"Why do you have to wipe so much snot out of your nose?" Parker asked.
"Because that's the way I am, that's why. Any objections?"
Garrity looked at his watch, but it was stopped at 10:16. He had forgotten to wind it.
"Anybody got the time?" he asked.
"Let me see."
Pearson squinted at his watch.
"Just half-ass an asshole, Garrity."
Everyone laughed.
"Come on," he said. "My watch stopped."
Pearson looked again. "It's 2 after 2. He looked up at the sky.
"That sun isn't going to set for a long time."
The sun was poised malevolently over the fringe of woods. There was not enough angle on it yet to throw the road into the shade, and wouldn't be for another hour or two. Far off to the south, Garrity thought he could see purple smudges that might be thunderheads, or only wishful thinking. Abraham and Collie Parker were lackadaisically discussing the merits of 4-barrel carbs. No one else seemed much disposed to talk, so Garrity wandered off by himself to the far side of the road, waving now and then to someone, but not bothering as a rule. The walkers were not spread out as much as they had been. The vanguard was in plain sight. 2 tall, tanned boys with black leather jackets tied around their waists. The word was that they were queer for each other, but Garrity believed that like he believed the moon was green cheese. They didn't look effeminate, and they seemed like nice enough guys. Not that either one of those things had much to do with whether or not they were queer, he supposed. And not that it was any of his business if they were, but... Barkovich was behind the leather boys, and McBreeze was behind him, staring intently at Barkovich's back. The yellow rain hat still dangled out of Barkovich's back pocket, and he didn't look like he was cracking to Garrity. In fact, he thought with a painful twinge, McVries was the one who looked bushed. Behind McVries and Barkovich was a loose knot of 7 or 8 boys, the kind of carelessly knit confederation that seemed to form and reform during the course of the walk, new and old members constantly coming and going. Behind them was a smaller group, and behind that group was Scram, Pearson, Baker, Abraham, Parker, and Jensen, his group. There had been others with it near the start, and now he could barely remember their names. There were 2 groups behind his, and scattered through the whole raggle-taggle column like pepper through salt were the loners. A few of them, like Olson, were withdrawn and catatonic. Others, like Stebbins, seemed to genuinely prefer their own company. And almost all of them had that intent, frightened look stamped on their faces. Garrity had come to know that look so well. The guns came down and bore on one of the loners he had been looking at, a short, stoutish boy who was wearing a battered green silk vest. It seemed to Garrity that he had collected his final warning about 30 minutes ago. He threw a short, terrified glance at the guns and stepped up his pace. The guns lost their dreadful interest in him, at least for the time being. Garrity felt a sudden, incomprehensible rise in spirits. They couldn't be much more than 40 miles from Old Town and civilization now, if you wanted to call a mill, shoe, and canoe town civilization. They'd pull in there sometime late tonight and get on the turnpike. The turnpike would be smooth sailing, compared to this. On the turnpike, you could walk on the grassy median strip with your shoes off, if you wanted. Feel the cold dew. Good Christ, that would be great. He mopped his brow with his forearm. Maybe things were going to turn out okay after all. The purple smudges were a little closer, and they were definitely thunderheads. The guns went off, and he didn't even jump. The boy in the green silk vest had bought a ticket, and he was staring up at the sun. Not even death was that bad, maybe. Everybody, even the Major himself, had to face it sooner or later. So who was swindling who when you came right down to it? He made a mental note to mention that to McBreeze the next time they spoke. He picked up his heels a little and made up his mind to wave to the next pretty girl he saw. But before there was a pretty girl, there was the little Italian man. He was a caricature Italian man. A small guy with a battered felt hat and a black mustache that curled up at the ends. He was beside an old station wagon with the back hatch standing open. He was waving and grinning with incredibly white, incredibly square teeth. An insulating mat had been laid on the bottom of the station wagon's cargo compartment. The mat had been piled high with crushed ice, and peeking through the ice in dozens of places, like wide pink peppermint grins, were wedges of watermelon. Garrity felt his stomach flop over twice, exactly like a snap-rolling high diver. A sign on top of the station wagon read, "Dom Lontio loves all long walkers. Free watermelon." Several of the walkers, Abraham and Collie Parker among them, broke for the shoulder at a dog trot. All were warned. They were doing better than 4 an hour, but they were doing it in the wrong direction. Dom Lontio saw them coming and laughed, a crystal, joyous, uncomplicated sound. He clapped his hands, dug into the ice, and came out with double handfuls of pink, grinning watermelons. Garrity felt his mouth shrivel with want. "But they won't let him," he thought. "Just like they wouldn't let the storekeeper give the sodas. And then... but oh God, it'd taste good. Would it be too much, God, for them to be a little slow with the hook this time? Where did he get watermelon this time of year, anyway?" The long walkers milled outside the restraining ropes. The small crowd around Dom went mad with happiness. Second warnings were parceled out, and 3 state troopers appeared miraculously to restrain Dom, whose voice came loud and clear. "What you mean? What you mean I can't? These my watermelon, you dumb cop. I want to give, I'm going to give, hey? What you think? Get off of my case, you hard ass." One of the troopers made a grab for the watermelons Dom held in his hands. Another button hooked around him and slammed the cargo door of the wagon shut. "You bastards!" Garrity screamed with all his force. His shriek sped through the bright day like a glass spear, and one of the troopers looked around, startled, and
well, almost hangdog. "Stinking sons of bitches!" Garrity shrieked at them. "I wish your mothers had miscarried, you stinking whore sons!" "You tell them, Garrity!" someone else yelled, and it was Barkovich, grinning like a mouthful of tenpenny nails and shaking both of his fists at the state troopers. "You tell!" But they were all screaming now, and the troopers were not hand-picked long-walk soldiers fresh off the national squads. Their faces were red and embarrassed, but all the same they were hustling Dom and his double handfuls of cool pink grins away from the sidelines at double time. Dom either lost his English or gave it up. He began to yell fruity Italian curses. The crowd booed the state troopers. A woman in a floppy straw sun hat threw a transistor radio at one of them. It hit him in the head and knocked off his cap. Garrity felt sorry for the trooper, but continued to scream curses. He couldn't seem to help it. That word whoresons, he hadn't thought anybody ever used a word like that outside of books. Just as it seemed that Dom Lantio would be removed from their view for good, the little Italian slipped free and dashed back toward them, the crowd parting magically for him and closing, or trying to, against the police. One of the troopers threw a flying tackle at him, caught him around the knees, and spilled him forward. At the last instant of balance, Dom let his beautiful pink grins fly in a wide swinging throw. "Dom Lantio loves you all!" he cried. The crowd cheered hysterically. Dom landed headfirst in the dirt, and his hands were cuffed behind him in a trice. The watermelon slices arced and pinwheeled through the bright air, and Garrity laughed aloud and raised both hands to the sky and shook his fists triumphantly as he saw Abraham catch one with nonchalant deftness. Others were third-warned for stopping to pick up chunks of watermelon, but amazingly, no one was shot, and six, Garrity saw, of the boys had ended up with watermelon. The rest of them alternately cheered those who had managed to get some of it, or cursed the wooden-faced soldiers whose expressions were now satisfyingly interpreted to hold subtle chagrin. "I love everybody," Abraham bellowed. His grinning face was streaked with pink watermelon juice. He spat three brown seeds into the air. "God damn," Collie Parker said happily. "I'm goddamned, goddamned if I ain't." He drove his face into the watermelon, gobbled hungrily, then busted his piece in two. He threw half of it over to Garrity, who almost fumbled it in his surprise. "There you go, Hicksville," Collie shouted. "Don't say I never gave you nothing, you goddamn rube." Garrity laughed. "Go fuck yourself," he said. The watermelon was cold, cold. Some of the juice got up his nose, some more ran down his chin, and oh, sweet heaven, in his throat, running down his throat. He only let himself eat half. "Pete," he shouted, and tossed the remaining chunk to him. McBreeze caught it with a flashy backhand, showing the sort of stuff that makes college shortstops and maybe major league ballplayers. He grinned at Garrity and ate the melon. Garrity looked around and felt a crazy joy breaking through him, pumping at his heart, making him want to run around in circles on his hands. Almost everyone had gotten a scrap of the melon, even if it was no more than a scrap of the pink meat clinging to a seed. Stebbins, as usual, was the exception. He was looking at the road. There was nothing in his hands, no smile on his face. "Screw him," Garrity thought. But a little of the joy went out of him, nevertheless. His feet felt heavy again. He knew that it wasn't that Stebbins hadn't gotten any, or that Stebbins didn't want any. Stebbins didn't need any. 2:30 p.m. They had walked 121 miles. The thunderheads drifted closer. A cool breeze sprang up, chill against Garrity's hot skin. "It's going to rain again," he thought. "Good." The people at the sides of the road were rolling up blankets, catching flying bits of paper, reloading their picnic baskets. The storm came flying lazily at them, and all at once the temperature plummeted, and it felt like autumn. Garrity buttoned his shirt quickly. "Here it comes again," he told Scram. "Better get your shirt on." "Are you kidding?" Scram grinned. "This is the best I've felt all day." "It's going to be a boomer," Parker yelled gleefully. They were on top of a gradually slanting plateau, and they could see the curtain of rain beating across the woods toward them below the purple thunderheads. Directly above them, the sky had gone a sick yellow. A tornado sky, Garrity thought. Wouldn't that be the living end?
What would they do if a tornado just came tearing ass down the road and carried them all off to Oz in a whirling cloud of dirt, flapping shoe leather, and whirling watermelon seeds? He laughed. The wind ripped the laugh out of his mouth. McVreeze! McVreeze angled to meet him. He was bent into the wind, his clothes plastered against his body and streaming out behind him. The black hair and the white scar etched against his tanned face made him look like a weathered, slightly mad sea captain astride the bridge of his ship. "What?" he bellowed. "Is there a provision in the rules for an act of God?" McVreeze considered. "No, I don't think so." He began buttoning his jacket. "What happens if we get struck by lightning?" McVreeze threw back his head and cackled. "We'll be dead!" Garrity snorted and walked away. Some of the others were looking up into the sky anxiously. This was going to be no little shower, the kind that had cooled them off after yesterday's heat. What had Parker said? A boomer. Yes, it certainly was going to be a boomer. A baseball cap went cartwheeling between his legs, and Garrity looked over his shoulder and saw a small boy looking after it longingly. Scram grabbed it and tried to scale it back to the kid, but the wind took it in a big boomerang arc, and it wound up in a wildly lashing tree. Thunder whacked. A white-purple tine of lightning jabbed the horizon. The comforting suff of the wind in the pines had become 100 mad ghosts, flapping and hooting. The guns cracked. A small popgun sound, almost lost in the thunder and the wind. Garrity jerked his head around. The premonition that Olson had finally bought his bullet strong upon him. But Olson was still there, his flapping clothes revealing how amazingly fast the weight had melted off him. Olson had lost his jacket somewhere. The arms that poked out of his short shirt sleeves were bony and as thin as pencils. It was somebody else who was being dragged off. The face was small and exhausted and very dead beneath the whipping mane of his hair. "If it was a tailwind, we could be in Old Town by 4:30, Barkovich said gleefully. He had his rain hat jammed down over his ears, and his sharp face was joyful and demented. Garrity suddenly understood. He reminded himself to tell McVreeze. Barkovich was crazy. A few minutes later, the wind suddenly dropped off. The thunder faded to a series of thick mutters. The heat sucked back at them, clammy and nearly unbearable after the rushy coolness of the wind. "What happened to it?" Collie Parker brayed. "Garrity, is this goddamn state punk out on its rainstorms, too?" "I think you'll get what you want," Garrity said. "I don't know if you'll want it when you get it, though."
"Yoo-hoo! Raymond! Raymond Garrity!"
Garrity's head jerked up. For one awful moment, he thought it was his mother, and visions of Percy danced through his head. But it was only an elderly, sweet-faced lady peeping at him from beneath a Vogue magazine she was using as a rain hat. "Oh, bag," Art Baker muttered at his elbow. "She looks sweet enough to me. Do you know her?" "I know the type," Baker said balefully. "She looks just like my Aunt Hattie. She used to like to go to funerals, listen to the weeping and wailing and carrying ons with just that same smile, like a cat that got into the eggs." "She's probably the Major's mother," Garrity said. It was supposed to be funny, but it fell flat. Baker's face was strained and pallid under the fading light in the rushing sky. "My Aunt Hattie had 9 kids. 9, Garrity. She buried 4 of them with just that same look, her own young. Some folks like to see other folks die. I can't understand that, can you?" "No," Garrity said. Baker was making him uneasy. The thunder had begun to roll its wagons across the sky again. "Your Aunt Hattie, is she dead now?" "No." Baker looked up at the sky. "She's down home. Probably out on the front porch in her rocking chair. She can't walk much anymore. Just sitting and rocking and listening to the bulletins on the radio, and smiling each time she hears the new figures." Baker rubbed his elbows with his palms. "You ever see a cat eat its own kittens, Garrity?" Garrity didn't reply. There was an electric tension in the air now, something about the storm poised above them, and something more. Garrity could not fathom it. When he blinked his eyes, he seemed to see the out-of-kilter eyes of Freaky D'Alessio looking back at him from the darkness.
Finally, he said to Baker, "Does everybody in your family study up on dying?" Baker smiled pallidly. "Well, I was turning over the idea of going to mortician school in a few years. Good job. Morticians go on eating, even in a depression. I always thought I'd get into urinal manufacture," Garrity said. "Get contracts with cinemas and bowling alleys and things. Sure fire. How many urinal factories can there be in the country?" "I don't think I'd still want to be a mortician," Baker said. "Not that it matters." A huge flash of lightning tore across the sky. A gargantuan clap of thunder followed. The wind picked up in jerky gusts. Clouds raced across the sky like crazed privateers across an ebony nightmare sea. "It's coming," Garrity said. "It's coming, Art." "Some people say they don't care," Baker said suddenly. "Something simple, that's all I want when I go, Don." That's what they'd tell him, my uncle. "But most of them care plenty. That's what he always told me. They say, just a pine box will do me fine. But they end up having a big one, with a lead sleeve if they can afford it. Lots of them even write the model number in their wills." "Why?" Garrity asked. "Down home, most of them want to be buried in mausoleums, above ground. They don't want to be underground because the water table's so high where I come from. Things rot quick in the damp. But if you're buried above ground, you got the rats to worry about. Big Louisiana bayou rats, graveyard rats. They'd gnaw through one of them pine boxes in zip flat." The wind pulled at them with invisible hands. Garrity wished the storm would come on and come. It was like an insane merry-go-round. No matter who you talked to, you came around to this damned subject again. "Be fucked if I'd do it," Garrity said. "Lay out $1,500 or something just to keep the rats away after I was dead." "I don't know," Baker said. His eyes were half-lidded, sleepy. "They go for the soft parts. That's what troubles my mind. I could see 'em worrying a hole in my own coffin, then making it bigger, finally wriggling through, and going right for my eyes like they was jujubes. They'd eat my eyes, and then I'd be part of that rat. Ain't that right?" "I don't know," Garrity said sickly. "No, thanks. I'll take that coffin with the lead sleeve every time." "Although you'd only actually need it the once," Garrity said with a horrified little giggle. "That is true," Baker agreed solemnly. Lightning forked again, an almost pink streak that left the air smelling of ozone. A moment later, the storm smote them again. But it wasn't rain this time. It was hail. In the space of 5 seconds, they were being pelted by hailstones the size of small pebbles. Several of the boys cried out, and Garrity shielded his eyes with one hand. The wind rose to a shriek. Hailstones bounced and smashed against the road, against faces and bodies. Jensen ran in a huge rambling circle, eyes covered, feet stumbling and rebounding against each other in a total panic. He finally blundered off the shoulder, and the soldiers on the half-track pumped half a dozen rounds into the undulating curtain of hail before they could be sure. "Goodbye, Jensen," Garrity thought. "Sorry, man." Then rain began to fall through the hail, sluicing down the hill they were climbing, melting the hail scattered around their feet. Another wave of stones hit them. More rain. Another splatter of hail. And then the rain was falling in steady sheets, punctuated by loud claps of thunder. "God damn!" Parker yelled, striding up to Garrity. His face was covered with red blotches, and he looked like a drowned water rat.
"Garrity, this is without a doubt..."
"Yeah, the most fucked up state in the 51," Garrity finished. "Go soak your head." Parker threw his head back, opened his mouth, and let the cold rain patter in.
"I am, goddammit, I am!"
Garrity bent himself into the wind and caught up with McVries. "How does this grab you?" he asked. McVries clutched himself and shivered. "You can't win. Now I wish the sun was out." "It won't last long," Garrity said. But he was wrong. As they walked into 4 o'clock, it was still raining. Chapter 10. Do you know why they call me the Count? Because I love to count. Ah ha ha!
The Count, Sesame Street. There was no sunset as they walked into their second night on the road. The rainstorm gave way to a light, chilling drizzle around 4:30. The drizzle continued on until almost 8 o'clock. Then the clouds began to break up and show bright, coldly flickering stars. Garrity pulled himself closer together inside his damp clothes and did not need a weatherman to know which way the wind blew. Fickle spring had pulled the balmy warmth that had come with him this far from beneath them like an old rug. Maybe the crowds provided some warmth, radiant heat or something. More and more of them lined the road. They were huddled together for warmth, but were undemonstrative. They watched the walkers go past and then went home, or hurried on to the next vantage point. If it was blood the crowds were looking for, they hadn't gotten much of it. They had lost only two since Jensen, both of them younger boys who had simply fainted dead away. That put them exactly halfway. No, really more than half. 50 down, 49 to go. Garrity was walking by himself. He was too cold to be sleepy. His lips were pressed together to keep the tremble out of them. Olson was still back there. Half-hearted bets had gone round to the effect that Olson would be the 50th to buy a ticket, the halfway boy. But he hadn't. That signal honor had gone to 13, Roger Feenham. Unlucky old 13. Garrity was beginning to think that Olson would go on indefinitely. Maybe until he starved to death. He had locked himself safely away in a place beyond pain. In a way, he supposed it would be poetic justice if Olson won. He could see the headlines. Long walk won by dead man. Garrity's toes were numb. He wiggled them against the shredded inner linings of his shoes and could feel nothing. The real pain was not in his toes now. It was in his arches. A sharp blatting pain that knifed up into his calves each time he took a step. It made him think of a story his mother had read him when he was small. It was about a mermaid who wanted to be a woman, only she had a tail. And a good fairy or someone said she could have legs if she wanted them badly enough. Every step she took on dry land would be like walking on knives, but she could have them if she wanted them, and she said, yeah, okay, and that was the long walk, in a nutshell. Warning, warning 47. I hear you, Garrity snapped crossly, and picked up his feet. The woods were thinner. The real northern part of the state was behind them. They had gone through two quietly residential towns, the road cutting them lengthwise, and the sidewalks packed with people that were little more than shadows beneath the drizzle-diffused street lamps. No one cheered much. It was too cold, he supposed. Too cold and too dark, and Jesus Christ, now he had another warning to walk off, and if that wasn't a royal pisser, nothing was. His feet were slowing again, and he forced himself to pick them up. Somewhere, quite far up ahead, Barkovich said something, and followed it up with a short burst of his unpleasant laughter. He could hear McBreeze's response clearly. Shut up, killer. Barkovich told McBreeze to go to hell, and now he seemed quite upset by the whole thing. Garrity smiled wanly in the darkness. He had dropped back almost to the tail of the column and reluctantly realized he was angling toward Stebbins again. Something about Stebbins fascinated him, but he decided he didn't particularly care what that something was. It was time to give up wondering about things. There was no percentage in it. It was just another royal pisser. There was a huge luminescent arrow ahead in the dark. It glowed like an evil spirit. Suddenly a brass band struck up a march, a good-sized band by the sound. There were louder cheers. The air was full of drifting fragments, and for a crazy moment Garrity thought it was snowing. But it wasn't snow. It was confetti. They were changing roads. The old one met the new one at a right angle, and another main turnpike sign announced that Old Town was now a mere 16 miles away. Garrity felt a tentative feeler of excitement, maybe even pride. After Old Town, he knew the route. He could have traced it on the palm of his hand. Maybe it's your edge. I don't think so, but maybe it is. Garrity jumped. It was as if Stebbins had pried the lid off his mind and peeked down inside. What? It's your country, isn't it? Not up here. I've never been north of Greenbush in my life, except when we drove up to the marker. And we didn't come this way.
They left the brass band behind them, its tubas and clarinets glistening softly in the moist night. But we go through your hometown, don't we?
No, but close by.
Stebbins grunted. Garrity looked down at Stebbins's feet and saw with surprise that Stebbins had removed his tennis shoes and was wearing a pair of soft-looking moccasins. His shoes were tucked into a chambray shirt.
I'm saving the tennis shoes, Stebbins said, just in case. But I think the mocks will finish it.
Oh. They passed a radio tower standing skeletal in an empty field. A red light pulsed as regular as a heartbeat at its tip.
Looking forward to seeing your loved ones?
Yes, I am, Garrity said.
What happens after that?
Happens?
Garrity shrugged.
Keep on walking down the road, I guess.
Unless you are all considerate enough to buy out by then.
Oh, I don't think so, Stebbins said, smiling remotely.
Are you sure you won't be walked out after you see them?
Man, I'm not sure of anything, Garrity said. I didn't know much when I started, and I know less now.
You think you have a chance?
I don't know that either. I don't even know why I bothered talking to you. It's like talking to smoke.
Far ahead, police sirens howled and gobbled in the night.
Somebody broke through to the road up ahead where the police are spread thinner, Stebbins said.
The natives are getting restless, Garrity.
Just think of all the people diligently making way for you up ahead.
For you, too.
Me, too, Stebbins agreed, then didn't say anything for a long time.
The collar of his chambray work shirt flapped vacuously against his neck.
It's amazing how the mind operates the body, he said at last. It's amazing how it can take over and dictate to the body. Your average housewife may walk up to 16 miles a day, from icebox to ironing board to clothesline. She's ready to put her feet up at the end of the day, but she's not exhausted. A door-to-door salesman might do 20. A high school kid in training for football walks 25 to 28. That's in one day, from getting up in the morning to going to bed at night. All of them get tired, but none of them get exhausted.
Yeah.
But suppose you told the housewife, today you must walk 16 miles before you can have your supper.
Garrity nodded. She'd be exhausted instead of tired.
Stebbins said nothing. Garrity had the perverse feeling that Stebbins was disappointed in him.
Well, wouldn't she?
Don't you think she'd have her 16 miles in by noon so she could kick off her shoes and spend the afternoon washing the soaps?
I do.
Are you tired, Garrity?
Yeah, Garrity said shortly.
I'm tired.
Exhausted?
Well, I'm getting there.
No, you're not getting exhausted yet, Garrity.
He jerked a thumb at Olson's silhouette. That's exhausted. He's almost through now.
Garrity watched Olson, fascinated, almost expecting him to drop at Stebbins's word.
What are you driving at?
Ask your cracker friend, Art Baker. A mule doesn't like to plow, but he likes carrots, so you hang a carrot in front of his eyes. A mule without a carrot gets exhausted. A mule with a carrot spends a long time being tired. You get it?
No. Stebbins smiled again. You will. Watch Olson. He's lost his appetite for the carrot. He doesn't quite know it yet, but he has. Watch Olson, Garrity. You can learn from Olson.
Garrity looked at Stebbins closely, not sure how seriously to take him.
Stebbins laughed aloud. His laugh was rich and full. A startling sound that made other walkers turn their heads.
Go on. Go talk to him, Garrity. And if he won't talk, just get up close and have a good look. It's never too late to learn.
Garrity swallowed.
Is it a very important lesson, would you say?
Stebbins stopped laughing. He caught Garrity's wrist in a strong grip.
The most important lesson you'll ever learn, maybe. The secret of life over death.
Reduce that equation and you can afford to die, Garrity. You can spend your life like a drunkard on a spree.
Stebbins dropped his hand. Garrity massaged his wrist slowly. Stebbins seemed to have dismissed him again. Nervously, Garrity walked away from him and toward Olson. It seemed to Garrity that he was drawn toward Olson on an invisible wire. He flanked him at 4 o'clock. He tried to fathom Olson's face. Once, a long time ago, he had been frightened into a long night of wakefulness by a movie starring... who? It had been Robert Mitchum, hadn't it? He had been playing the role of an implacable Southern revival minister who had also been a compulsive murderer. In silhouette, Olson looked a little bit like him now. His form had seemed to elongate as the weight sloughed off him. His skin had gone scaly with dehydration. His eyes had sunk into hollowed sockets. His hair flew aimlessly on his skull like wind-driven corn silk. Why, he's nothing but a robot. Nothing but an automaton, really. Can there still be an Olson in there hiding? No, he's gone. I am quite sure that the Olson who sat on the grass and joked and told about the kid who froze on the starting line and bought his ticket right there, that Olson is gone. This is a dead play thing. Olson? He whispered. Olson walked on. He was a shambling haunted house on legs. Olson had fouled himself. Olson smelled bad. Olson, can you talk? Olson swept onward. His face was turned into the darkness, and he was moving. Yes, he was moving. Something was going on here. Something was still ticking over, but... something, yes. There was something, but what? They breasted another rise. The breath came shorter and shorter in Garrity's lungs until he was panting like a dog. Tiny vapors of steam rose from his wet clothes. There was a river below them, lying in the dark like a silver snake. The Stillwater, he imagined. The Stillwater passed near Old Town. A few half-hearted cheers went up, but not many. Further on, nestled against the far side of the river's dogleg, maybe it was the Penobscot after all, was a nestle of lights. Old Town. A smaller nestle of light on the other side would be Milford and Bradley. Old Town. They had made it to Old Town. Olson, he said. That's Old Town. Those lights are Old Town. We're getting there, fellow. Olson made no answer. And now he could remember what had been eluding him, and it was nothing so vital after all. Just that Olson reminded him of the Flying Dutchman, sailing on and on after the whole crew had disappeared. They walked rapidly down a long hill, passed through an S-curve, and crossed a bridge that spanned, according to the sign, Meadow Brook. On the far side of this bridge was another Steep Hill Trucks Use Low Gear sign. There were groans from some of the walkers. It was indeed a steep hill. It seemed to rise above them like a toboggan slide. It was not long. Even in the dark, they could see the summit. But it was steep, all right. Plenty steep. They started up. Garrity leaned into the slope, feeling his grip on his respiration start to trickle away almost at once. Be panting like a dog at the top, he thought. And then thought, if I get to the top... There was a protesting clamor rising in both legs. It started in his thighs and worked its way down. His legs were screaming at him that they simply weren't going to do this shit any longer. But you will, Garrity told him. You will or you'll die. I don't care, his legs answered back. Don't care if I do die, do die, do die. The muscles seemed to be softening, melting like jello left out in the hot sun. They trembled almost helplessly. They twitched like badly controlled puppets. Warnings cracked out right and left, and Garrity realized he would be getting one for his very own soon enough. He kept his eyes fixed on Olson, forcing himself to match his pace to Olson's. They would make it together up over the top of this killer hill, and then he would get Olson to tell him his secret. Then everything would be Jake, and he wouldn't have to worry about Stebbins or McBreeze or Jan or his father. No, not even about Freaky D'Alessio, who had spread his head on a stone wall beside US-1 like a dollop of glue. What was it, 100 feet on? 50? What? Now he was panting. The first gunshots rang out. There was a loud yipping scream that was drowned by more gunshots. And at the brow of the hill they got one more. Garrity could see nothing in the dark.
His tortured pulse hammered in his temples. He found that he didn't give a fuck who had bought it this time. It didn't matter. Only the pain mattered. The tearing pain in his legs and lungs. The hill rounded, flattened, and rounded still more on the downslope. The far side was gently sloping, perfect for regaining wind. But that soft jelly feeling in his muscles didn't want to leave. My legs are going to collapse, Garrity thought calmly. They'll never take me as far as Freeport. I don't think I can make it to Old Town. I'm dying, I think. A sound began to beat its way into the night then, savage and orgiastic. It was a voice. It was many voices, and it was repeating the same thing over and over. Garrity, 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 Garrity. It was God or his father about to cut the legs out from under him before he could learn the secret. The secret? The secret of... Like thunder. Garrity! 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 It wasn't his father, and it wasn't God. It was what appeared to be the entire student body of Old Town High School, chanting his name in unison. As they caught sight of his white, weary, and strained face, the steady beating cry dissolved into wild cheering. Cheerleaders fluttered pom-poms. Boys whistled shrilly and kissed their girls. Garrity waved back, smiled, nodded, and craftily crept closer to Olson. Olson, he whispered. Olson. Olson's eyes might have flickered a tiny bit. A spark of life, like the single turn of an old starter in a junked automobile. Tell me how, Olson, he whispered. Tell me what to do. The high school girls and boys. Did I once go to high school? Garrity wondered. Was that a dream? We're behind them now, still cheering rapturously. Olson's eyes moved jerkily in their sockets, as if long rusted and in need of oil. His mouth fell open with a nearly audible clunk. That's it, Garrity whispered eagerly. Talk. Talk to me, Olson. Tell me. Tell me. Ah, Olson said. Ah. Ah. Garrity moved even closer. He put a hand on Olson's shoulder and leaned into an evil nimbus of sweat, halitosis, and urine. Please, Garrity said. Try hard. God's garden. God's garden? Garrity repeated doubtfully. What about God's garden, Olson? It's full of weeds, Olson said sadly. His head bounced against his chest. I... Garrity said nothing. He could not. They were going up another hill now, and he was panting again. Olson did not seem to be out of breath at all. I don't want to die, Olson finished. Garrity's eyes were soldered to the shadowed ruin that was Olson's face. Olson turned creakily toward him. Huh? Olson raised his lolling head slowly. Garrity?
Yes, it's me.
What time is it? Garrity had rewound and reset his watch earlier. God knew why. It's 9:15.
No.
No later than that. Mild surprise washed over Olson's shattered old man's face.
Olson!
He shook Olson's shoulder gently, and Olson's whole frame seemed to tremble like a gantry in a high wind.
What's it all about?
Suddenly Garrity cackled madly.
What's it all about, Alfie?
Olson looked at Garrity with calculated shrewdness.
Garrity,
he whispered. His breath was like a sewer draft.
What?
What time is it?
Damn it!
Garrity shouted at him. He turned his head quickly, but Stebbins was staring down at the road. If he was laughing at Garrity, it was too dark to see.
Garrity?
What?
Garrity said more quietly.
Jesus
will save you. Olson's head came up all the way. He began to walk off the road. He was walking at the half-track.
Warning! Warning, 70!
Olson never slowed. There was a ruinous dignity about him. The gabble of the crowd quieted. They watched, wide-eyed. Olson never hesitated. He reached the soft shoulder. He put his hands over the side of the half-track. He began to clamber painfully up the side.
"Olson!"
Abraham yelled, startled. "Hey, that's Hank Olson!" The soldiers brought their guns around in perfect four-part harmony. Olson grabbed the barrel of the closest and yanked it out of the hands that held it as if it had been an ice cream stick. It clattered off into the crowd. They shrank from it, screaming as if it had been a live adder. Then one of the other three guns went off. Garrity saw the flash at the end of the barrel quite clearly. He saw the jerky ripple of Olson's shirt as the bullet entered his belly and then punched out the back. Olson did not stop. He gained the top of the half-track and grabbed the barrel of the gun that had just shot him. He levered it up into the air as it went off again.
"Get him!"
McVries was screaming savagely up ahead.
"Get him, Olson! Kill him! Kill him!"
The other two guns roared in unison, and the impact of the heavy-caliber slugs sent Olson flying off the half-track. He landed straight-eagled on his back, like a man nailed to a cross. One side of his belly was a black and shredded ruin. Three more bullets were pumped into him. The guard Olson had disarmed had produced another carbine, effortlessly, from inside the half-track. Olson sat up. He put his hands against his belly and stared calmly at the poised soldiers on the deck of the squat vehicle. The soldiers stared back.
"You bastards,"
McBreeze sobbed.
"You bloody bastards."
Olson began to get up. Another volley of bullets drove him flat again. Now there was a sound from behind Garrity. He didn't have to turn his head to know it was Stebbins. Stebbins was laughing softly. Olson sat up again. The guns were still trained on him, but the soldiers did not shoot. Their silhouettes on the half-track seemed almost to indicate curiosity. Slowly, reflectively, Olson gained his feet, hands crossed on his belly. He seemed to sniff the air for direction, turned slowly in the direction of the walk, and began to stagger along.
"Put him out of it!" a shocked voice screamed hoarsely. "For Christ's sake, put him out of it!"
The blue snakes of Olson's intestines were slowly slipping through his fingers. They dropped like link sausages against his groin, where they flapped obscenely. He stopped, bent over as if to retrieve them. Retrieve them, Garrity thought in a near ecstasy of wonder and horror, and threw up a huge glut of blood and bile. He began to walk again, bent over. His face was sweetly calm. "Oh, my God," Abraham said, and turned to Garrity with his hands cupped over his mouth. Abraham's face was white and cheesy. His eyes were bulging. His eyes were frantic with terror. "Oh, my God, Ray, what a fucking gross out. Oh, Jesus!" Abraham vomited. Puke sprayed through his fingers. "Well, old Abe has tossed his cookies," Garrity thought remotely. "That's no way to observe Hint 13, Abe." "They gut-shot him," Stebbins said from behind Garrity. "They'll do that. It's deliberate. To discourage anybody else from trying the old charge of the light brigade number."
"Get away from me," Garrity hissed, "or I'll knock your block off."
Stebbins dropped back quickly. "Warning, warning 88. Stebbins's laugh drifted softly to him. Olson went to his knees. His head hung between his arms, which were propped on the road. One of the rifles roared, and a bullet clipped asphalt beside Olson's left hand and whined away. He began to climb slowly, wearily, to his feet again. "They're playing with him," Garrity thought. "All of this must be terribly boring for them, so they are playing with Olson. Is Olson fun, boys? Is Olson keeping you amused?" Garrity began to cry. He ran over to Olson and fell on his knees beside him and held the tired, hectically hot face against his chest. He sobbed into the dry, bad-smelling hair.
"Warning, warning 47. Warning, warning 61.
McVries was pulling at him. It was McVries again.
"Get up, Ray, get up. You can't help him. For God's sake, get up."
"It's not fair," Garrity wept. There was a sticky smear of Olson's blood on his cheekbone.
"It's just not fair."
"I know. Come on, come on." Garrity stood up. He and McVries began walking backward rapidly, watching Olson, who was on his knees. Olson got to his feet. He stood astride the white line. He raised both hands up into the sky. The crowd sighed softly.
"I did it wrong," Olson shouted tremblingly, and then fell flat and dead. The soldiers on the half-track put another 2 bullets in him, and then dragged him busily off the road.
Yes, that's that.
They walked quietly for 10 minutes or so, Garrity drawing a low-key comfort just from McBreeze's presence.
I'm starting to see something in it, Pete, he said at last. There's a pattern. It isn't all senseless.
Yeah, don't count on it.
He talked to me, Pete. He wasn't dead until they shot him. He was alive.
Now it seemed that was the most important thing about the Olsen experience. He repeated it.
Alive! I don't think it makes any difference,
McBreeze said with a tired sigh. He's just a number, part of the body count, number 53. It means we're a little closer, and that's all it means.
You don't really think that.
Don't tell me what I think and what I don't, McBreeze said crossly. Leave it alone, can't you?
I put us about 13 miles outside of Old Town, Garrity said.
Well, hot shit. Do you know how Scram is? I'm not his doctor. Why don't you Scram yourself?
What the hell's eating you?
McVries laughed wildly.
Here we are, and you want to know what's eating me? I'm worried about next year's income taxes. That's what's eating me. I'm worried about the price of grain in South Dakota. That's what's eating me. Olson, his guts were falling out, Garrity. At the end, he was walking with his guts falling out, and that's eating me. That's eating me.
He broke off, and Garrity watched him struggle to keep from vomiting. Abruptly, McBreeze said, Scram's poor.
Is he?
Collie Parker felt his forehead and said he was burning up. He's talking funny. About his wife, about Phoenix, Flagstaff. Weird stuff about the Hopis and the Navajos and Kachina dolls. It's hard to make out.
How much longer can he go?
Who can say? He still might outlast us all. He's built like a buffalo and he's trying awful hard.
Jesus, am I tired. What about Barkovich? He's wising up. He knows a lot of us will be glad to see him buy a ticket to see the farm. He's made up his mind to outlast me, the nasty little fucker.
He doesn't like me shagging him. Tough shit, right, I know. McBreeze uttered his wild laugh again. Garrity didn't like the sound of it. He's scared, though. He's easing up on the lung power and going to leg power.
We all are.
Yeah. Old Town coming up. 13 miles?
That's right.
Can I say something to you, Garrity?
Sure, I'll carry it with me to the grave.
I suppose that's true. Someone near the front of the crowd set off a firecracker, and both Garrity and McBreeze jumped. Several women screeched. A burly man in the front row said, God damn it, through a mouthful of popcorn. The reason all of this is so horrible, McBreeze said, is because it's just trivial, you know? We've sold ourselves and traded our souls on trivialities. Olson, he was trivial. He was magnificent, too. But those things aren't mutually exclusive. He was magnificent and trivial, either way or both. He died like a bug under a microscope. You're as bad as Stebbins, Garrity said resentfully. I wish Priscilla had killed me, McBreeze said. At least that wouldn't have been trivial, Garrity finished.
Yes, I think... Look, I want to doze a little if I can, you mind?
No, I'm sorry. McBreeze sounded stiff and offended.
I'm sorry, Garrity said.
Look, don't take it to heart, it's really... Trivial, McBreeze finished. He laughed his wild laugh for the third time and walked away. Garrity wished, not for the first time, that he had made no friends on the long walk. It was going to make it hard. In fact, it was already hard. There was a sluggish stirring in his bowels. Soon they would have to be emptied. The thought made him grind his mental teeth. People would point and laugh. He would drop his shit in the street like a mongrel hound, and afterward people would gather it up in paper napkins and put it in bottles for souvenirs. It seemed impossible that people would do such things, but he knew it happened. Olson, with his guts falling out. McBreeze and Priscilla and the pajama factory. Scram, glowing, fever bright.
Abraham, what price stovepipe hat, audience?
Garrity's head dropped. He dozed. The walk went on.
Over hill, over dale, over stile and mountain, over ridge and under bridge and past my lady's fountain.
Garrity giggled in the dimming recesses of his brain.
His feet pounded the pavement, and the loose heel flapped looser, like an old shutter on a dead house. I think, therefore, I am. First year Latin class. Old tunes in a dead language. Ding-dong bell, pussies down the well. Who pushed her in? Little Jackie Flynn.
I exist, therefore I am. Another firecracker went off. There were whoops and cheers. The half-track ground and clattered, and Garrity listened for the sound of his number in a warning, and dozed deeper.
Daddy, I wasn't glad when you had to go, but I never really missed you when you were gone. Sorry. But that's not the reason I'm here. I have no subconscious urge to kill myself. Sorry, Stebbins. So sorry, but...
The guns again, startling him awake, and there was the familiar mail sack thud of another boy going home to Jesus. The crowd screamed its horror and roared its approval.
Garrity!
A woman squealed.
Ray Garrity!
Her voice was harsh and scabbed.
We're with you, boy! We're with you, Ray!
Her voice cut through the crowd, and heads turned, necks craned, so that they could get a better look at Maine's own. There were scattered boos, drowned in a rising cheer. The crowd took up the chant again. Garrity heard his name until it was reduced to a jumble of nonsense syllables that had nothing to do with him. He waved briefly and dozed again.
Chapter 11.
Come on, assholes, you want to live forever?
Unknown, World War I, Top Sergeant. They passed into Old Town around midnight. They switched through two feeder roads, joined Route 2, and went through the center of town. For Ray Garrity, the entire passage was a blurred, sleep-hazed nightmare. The cheering rose and swelled until it seemed to cut off any possibility of thought or reason. Night was turned into glaring, shadowless day by flaring arc-sodium lamps that threw a strange orange light. In such a light, even the most friendly face looked like something from a crypt. Confetti, newspaper, shredded pieces of telephone book, and long streamers of toilet paper floated and soared from second and third story windows. It was a New York ticker tape parade in Bush League, USA. No one died in Old Town. The orange arc lamps faded, and the crowd depleted a little as they walked along the Stillwater River in the trench of morning. It was May 3rd now. The ripe smell of paper mill smote them. A juicy smell of chemicals, wood smoke, polluted river, and stomach cancer waiting to happen. There were conical piles of sawdust higher than the buildings downtown. Heaped stacks of pulpwood stood to the sky like monoliths. Garrity dozed and dreamed his shadowy dreams of relief and redemption, and after what seemed to be an eternity, someone began jabbing him in the ribs. It was McVreeze.
What's the matter?
We're going on the turnpike,
McVreeze said. He was excited.
The word's back. They got a whole son-of-a-bitch in color guard on the entrance ramp. We're going to get a 400-gun salute.
Into the Valley of Death rode the 400, Garrity muttered, rubbing the sleepy seeds out of his eyes. I've heard too many 3-gun salutes tonight. Not interested. Let me sleep.
That isn't the point. After they get done, we're going to give them a salute.
We are?
Yeah. A 46-man raspberry.
Garrity grinned a little. It felt stiff and uncertain on his lips.
That right?
It certainly is. Well, a 40-man raspberry. A few of the guys are pretty far gone now.
Garrity had a brief vision of Olson, the human Flying Dutchman.
Well, count me in, he said.
Bunch up with us a little then.
Garrity picked it up. He and McVreeze moved in tighter with Pearson, Abraham, Baker, and Scram. The leather boys had further shortened their vanguard.
Barkovich in on it? Garrity asked. McVreeze snorted. He thinks it's the greatest idea since pay toilets.
Garrity clutched his cold body a little tighter to himself and let out a humorless little giggle.
I bet he's got a hell of a wicked raspberry. They were paralleling the turnpike now. Garrity could see the steep embankment to his right, and the fuzzy glow of more arc sodiums, bone white this time, above. A distance ahead, perhaps half a mile, the entrance ramp split off and climbed. "Here we come," McVree said.
"Kathy!"
Scram yelled suddenly, making Garrity start.
"I ain't gave up yet, Kathy."
He turned his blank, fever-glittering eyes on Garrity. There was no recognition in them. His cheeks were flushed, his lips cracked with fever blisters. "He ain't so good," Baker said apologetically, as if he had caused it. "We've been giving him water every now and again, also sort of pouring it over his head. But his canteen's almost empty, and if he wants another one, he'll have to holler for it himself. It's the rules."
"Scram,"
Garrity said.
"Who's that?"
Scram's eyes rolled wildly in their sockets.
"Me, Garrity." "Oh, you seen Kathy?"
"No," Garrity said uncomfortably. "Here we come," McVree said. The crowd's cheers rose in volume again, and a ghostly green sign came out of the darkness. "Interstate 95, Augusta, Portland, Portsmouth, points south."
"That's us," Abraham whispered.
"God help us and point south." The exit ramp tilted up under their feet. They passed into the first splash of light from the overhead arcs. The new paving was smoother beneath their feet, and Garrity felt a familiar lift drop of excitement. The soldiers of the color guard had displaced the crowd along the upward spiral of the ramp. They silently held their rifles to high port. Their dress uniforms gleamed resplendently. Their own soldiers, in their dusty half-track, looked shabby by comparison. It was like rising above a huge and restless sea of noise and into the calm air. The only sound was their footfalls and the hurried pace of their breathing. The entrance ramp seemed to go on forever, and always the way was fringed by soldiers in scarlet uniforms, their arms held in high-port salute. And then, from the darkness somewhere, came the major's electronically amplified voice. "Present arms!" Weapons slapped flesh. "Salute ready!" Guns to shoulders pointed skyward above them in a steely arch. Everyone instinctively huddled together against the crash which meant death. It had been Pavlov'd into them.
"Fire!"
400 guns in the night, stupendous, ear-shattering. Garrity fought down the urge to put his hands to his head.
"Fire!"
Again the smell of powder smoke, acrid, heavy with cordite. In what book did they fire guns over the water to bring the body of a drowned man to the surface?
"My head," Scram moaned. "Oh, Jesus, my head aches." "Fire!"
The guns exploded for the third and last time. McVree's immediately turned around and walked backward, his face going a spotty red with the effort it cost him to shout.
"Present arms!"
40 tongues pursed 40 sets of lips.
"Salute ready!"
Garrity drew breath into his lungs and fought to hold it.
"Fire!"
It was pitiful, really, a pitiful little noise of defiance in the big dark. It was not repeated. The wooden faces of their color guard did not change, but seemed all the same to indicate a subtle reproach.
"Oh, screw it," said McGreeves.
He turned around and began to walk frontwards again with his head down. The pavement leveled off. They were on the turnpike. There was a brief vision of the major's jeep spurting away to the south, a flicker of cold fluorescent light against black sunglasses, and then the crowd closed in again, but farther from them now, for the highway was 4 lanes wide, 5 if you counted the grassy median strip. Garrity angled to the median quickly and walked in the close-cropped grass, feeling the dew seep through his cracked shoes and paint his ankles. Someone was warned. The turnpike stretched ahead, flat and monotonous. Stretches of concrete tubing divided by this green inset, all of it banded together by strips of white light from the arc sodiums above. Their shadows were sharp and clear and long, as if thrown by a summer moon. Garrity tipped his canteen up, swigged deep, recapped it, and began to doze again. 80, maybe 84 miles to Augusta. The feel of the wet grass was soothing. He stumbled, almost fell, and came awake with a jerk. Some fool had planted pines on the median strip. He knew it was the state tree, but wasn't that taking it a little far? How could they expect you to walk on the grass when there were... They didn't, of course. Garrity moved over to the left lane, where most of them were walking.
Two more half-tracks had rattled onto the turnpike at the Orono entrance to fully cover the 46 walkers now left. They didn't expect you to walk on the grass. Another joke on you, Garrity, old sport. Nothing vital, just another little disappointment. Trivial, really. Just don't dare wish for anything, and don't count on anything. The doors are closing. One by one, they're closing.
They'll drop out tonight, he said. They'll go like bugs on a wall tonight.
I wouldn't count on it, Collie Parker said, and now he sounded worn and tired, subdued at last.
Why not? It's like shaking a box of crackers through a sieve, Garrity. The crumbs fall through pretty fast. Then the little pieces break up, and they go too. But the big crackers...
Parker's grin was a crescent flash of saliva-coated teeth in the darkness.
The whole crackers have to bust off a crumb at a time.
But such a long way to walk.
Still.
End of Side 8. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.